Welcome, and thank you for joining us for another episode of Insight is Capital. I'm your host, Pierre Daly. Over the summer, Fidelity Canada's global asset allocation team released their outlook titled On Our Way Home. In it, they discussed a bold move. After more than a decade of underweighting Canada, they signaled their shift back toward a neutral position in Canadian equities. They also raised a big question. If the U.S. dollar can't be counted on as the safe haven it once was, are we looking at the start of a whole new regime? Here we are in September. Markets have moved, policies have shifted, and investors are asking what's changed and what might come next. One of our favorite guests, Ilan Colette from Fidelity's Global Asset Allocation Team, is back with us. Ilan is an institutional portfolio manager for Fidelity Investments. In this role, Ilan serves as a member of the investment management team, maintaining a deep knowledge of portfolio philosophy, process, and construction. He works to assist portfolio managers and their CIOs in ensuring portfolios are managed in accordance with client expectations. If you've been following Insight is Capital, you know Ilan has been a regular guest, sharing his team's perspective on how big shifts in markets ripple through portfolios. It's always a thoughtful, grounded conversation when he joins. And with so much happening over the summer and year, we're excited to have him back to dig into what's changed and where things may be headed next.
This is Insight is Capital. Join us in our fireside chats with some of the most fascinating people in finance to discuss their insights on life, markets, macro, investment strategy, and much more.
Ilan, welcome. It is terrific to have you on.
Yeah, thanks so much, Pierre. That's a really kind introduction. Again, like, I think my head, after some of these introductions, my head's not going to fit through the door, but that's a very, very kind introduction. Always enjoy these chats.
Thank you. And likewise, I Ilan is well deserved. Again, it's terrific to have you back. And so, Ilan, where do we start? What a year it's been, despite all the tumult.
Yeah, you know, it has been pretty remarkable, right? So there's a lot of different directions we can go in, and I'm sure we'll go in a lot of them. But to me, I just think back, you know, we've had, you know, several conversations now at this point. I think what's really sort of stark to me is the tone of the conversations now versus even 1 year ago, right? Like when we were chatting a year ago, right? Which seems like a lifetime ago. A year ago.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, a year ago, the conversations we were having were around U.S. exceptionalism, productivity pushing higher, you know, the dividend from AI and remote work. I mean, I remember sharing with you these unbelievable labor market statistics showing huge increases in female labor force participation and disabled worker participation, really incredible things that you just don't see in the data. And we were leaning into the U.S. last year in the mandates that we run, in the funds that we manage for Canadian investors. And, you know, our global balanced managed portfolio had a tremendous return last year, in part because of the underlying performances of obviously the indexes, but also from us leaning into the U.S. and the growthy managers, some of the growthier managers that we use in the U.S. Fast forward to today. I mean, it's a very different story, right? You know, we're leaning away from the U.S. We have serious concerns around those underpinnings. I mean, and that's just one of the big changes that we've made now versus last year, right, is the U.S., and I can talk about Europe, gold, Canada, the Canadian dollar. I mean, as you know, Pierre, these funds, they're not getting whipped around every day, but we follow that four-pillar process, macro, bottom-up, sentiment, and valuation, and when the research and our process suggests a shift is necessary, those shifts are made.
Things changed dramatically in April. There was, you know, that question of U.S. exceptionalism really got called in,
yeah,
which was, you know, due to the fact that the bond market was reflecting a completely different outlook, the term premium, yields on the 30 year in the U.S. climbed to 5. Similarly, the yield on the U.S. 10 year climbed to 4.5. Now, we've had a bit of a pullback in yields more recently. But really, there's such a volatility in the rates market, which conflict with what we see happening in the equity market.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, now we see the equity market, the U.S. equity market seems to be like, in proportion to the worrying headlines that we've seen, the market has climbed in proportion to that worry. Like if you say the market climbs a wall of worry, it really has. It's continued to do so. Some of the underlying fundamentals, like earnings reports and that, have been exceeded, mm-hmm. Continue to perform well, and markets are responding to that. But still, we're still seeing this heavy concentration in the top 10 names of the S&P 500. You know, there were some big reports this past week that really accelerated that sentiment in over AI as the key tailwind to the market right now. But what a surprise, right? I mean,
no, really,
surprise in you know, versus what, you know, was potentially a dimmer outlook for U.S. equities and Canadian equities as well.
Yep.
We sort of, you know, we're sitting now at the end of the, you know, at the end of the, really almost at the very end of the summer in September, and wondering, wow, you know, what do I make of this?
Yeah, I mean, and I think, you know, to pick up on some of your points, Pierre, I think, you know, I've been looking at the last few days, just looking at some of these valuation charts and concentration charts that are really quite unbelievable, right? And I would agree that the U.S. market performance since April, has been a straight line higher at a time when I would argue that actually those headlines are getting more concerning, right? So headlines in the start of this year were tariffs, really tariff related. And I'm sure we'll talk about tariffs, but tariffs in my mind have been less of a disaster than I would have expected. Now we'll see. The last couple of employment reports have not been good, so we might just be at the beginning of this. But you know, I think maybe Canadian companies have managed to sort of sweep more things under that bucket or that dome of USMCA, and maybe we get a renegotiation. But you know, I would argue since April, the some of the headlines coming out of the U.S., right, the removal of the head of the statistical agency, you know, criminally investigating a member of the Federal Reserve, like these are not the types of headlines that give us warm and fuzzy feelings on the return of U.S. exceptionalism. I would say they further underpin our view that now is not the time to be leaning into the U.S. It's the time for us to be leaning away. And we are leaning away. And one quick clarification, I think, and I know you know this, Pierre, but just for everyone, when I talk about leaning away, it doesn't mean we are sold all our U.S. equities, right? This comes up a lot. Oh, you're leaning away from the U.S., but aren't you ignoring the AI dividend and the incredible things that are happening in the AI? And the answer is no, right? Call it 25% of our 60-40 is U.S. equities. We're trimming that by, say, 4%, 4.5%, 5%, allocating it to Europe. So there's still plenty of U.S. equities and great underlying managers where we can benefit from that really incredible AI dividend, which is potentially a secular theme, I think, right? That's not a cyclical theme.
Absolutely. I think, you know, yeah, to clarify, I mean, when you say that you're underweight, you know, that you're going, you know, from overweight to neutral in the U.S. and from underweight to neutral in Canada, That's the question should be, what is neutral? What is a neutral Canadian equities position? What is a neutral U.S. equities position?
Yeah, exactly. So it varies through types of funds, but for the 60-40 that we manage, 21% of the equities are Canadian. In the past, as we've talked about, this is the other really significant change. 21% of the equities are Canadian, call it 25% of the equities, 26% are U.S., et cetera. So that 60-40, this Dixie chunk, 21% are Canadian, 39% are not Canadian, right? But the other big change for us has been 21%, you know, the 21% Canadian equity allocation. We have had an underweight to Canadian equities, you know, for a long time, right? For a very long time.
Right.
It predates me on the team, you know, I would say probably 10, 11 years. And the very first chart in that paper, which is a great one, is just sort of a reminder. I mean, I think everyone realizes that for the last 10 years, right, 2014 to 2024, the U.S. decidedly outperformed Canada. had you not allocated to the U.S. instead of Canada, you would be poorer today, right? So that was certainly the right decision. And we had those underweights to Canada, Canadian equities, in favor of the U.S. But one thing I think people sometimes forget is from 2004 to 2014, Canada outperformed the U.S. Now, people are going to...
Yeah, that was partly the lost decade, right, in the S&P 500.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, so, and to your point, okay, we had a financial, 1 in 100 year financial crisis with almost, 10 million people losing their jobs. Like, so we had this massive negative for the U.S., but we also had the commodity tailwind pushing on the backs of Canada, right? Pushing on the back of Canada. I was at the Bank of Canada at the time covering commodities under Mark Carney and David Dodge. And I remember that quite well, that period quite well. But, 2004 to 2014 was a period in which Canada decidedly outperformed the U.S. And then it switched. And our view now is perhaps the conditions are at play where a return of Canadian outperformance is coming back. And that's as much to do with what's happening in the U.S. as what we think is happening in Canada.
Well, you've got this situation where, there's an increasing number of reports coming out about the capital markets expectations for U.S. stocks at the valuations that they're fetching now. The future returns of those same positions,
right,
is reduced in proportion to the amount by which they've gained. So
exactly.
And if you look at the relative underperformance over the last decade plus for Canada, the return expectations have risen because of the underperformance.
Right.
As a result of the underperformance. So it's not that it's very easy, I think, if you look at, any given individual stock or a group of stocks like, the Mag 7, mm-hmm, Magnificent 10, whatever you want to call them, they're great companies. They are the most phenomenal companies in history.
Yeah, some of them, definitely.
In the history of the stock market. But that doesn't mean they're going to be necessarily great stocks.
Well,
yes, in some cases they likely will, but if we go back to the tech wreck, there was tons of great companies like Cisco Systems, for example, as an exemplary, which following the tech wreck had, a decade plus, more than a decade of, lost returns.
No, Pierre, that's a good...
It's still a great company, yeah, but it's not a great stock. It wasn't a great stock.
Right. So that's a very good point. I mean, I grew up in part in Ottawa, right? And so I didn't grow up far from that enormous Nortel campus.
A Nortel.
Exactly. In the west side, yeah, of Ottawa, and Carell, like I drove by all the time. And away to university and stuff. So you're absolutely right. What I would say is, in thinking about that asset allocation between Canada and the U.S., one of the things valuations are an important, and valuation and sentiment are two important pillars in our four-pillar process. And one of the questions we're asking ourselves right now, and there's no question that AI is revolutionary. I'm using it daily, personally and professionally. Even right now, Pierre, you're actually talking to an avatar. No, I'm just joking. I'll say, but
that's very good.
But the truth is, I think things are, things in the U.S. to us appear to be kind of priced for perfection, right? And some of those headlines that we've talked about are far from perfect. In Canada, it's an interesting story, right? So in Canada, again, we've been underweight Canadian equities for some time, instead favoring the U.S., and that was the right decision. But I would say right now we're cautiously optimistic. And, I have a colleague who says, I might screw up this line, but if things are going from very bad to bad or very awful to awful, right, that inflection, right, there's a lot of basis points to be added, from that change. And that's some of the way that we have to think about asset allocation in the context of our funds is, again, we're never just thinking about sort of absolute returns. We're always thinking, right, in relative space. As asset allocators, you can't be defensive everywhere. So, and nor would you want to be. And so following that research process, we're seeing, our asset allocation research team is seeing, you know, recession risk coming off highs in Canada and kind of sort of ticking higher in the US. And, you know, I know we're going to get into rates and the Bank of Canada and the job market and all that other stuff. But I mean, rates are heading lower in Canada. Maybe we're getting past the worst of the housing market, you know, sort of doom spiral that we had entered into in Canada. I mean, there's probably more work to be done, but
right.
That question is, if we're coming from sort of a sentiment perspective, if we're coming off that bottom and valuations are attractive and sort of the price is right, is it the time not necessarily to be overweight Canada, but just no longer be underweight? Again, we have taken that underweight in Canadian equities to a neutral, right? And are roughly neutral versus our strategic allocation. We're not leaning in and not leaning out. Other thing I would highlight here is, like, you know, if a really keen listener listens to this and then rewinds to our first conversation, they're going to go, wow, this guy really is flip-flopping. I'd be impressed if someone does that. But I don't want to ignore that the fact that the long-term structural issues in Canada, they haven't just disappeared, right? So all of those things that we've talked about in the past, too much of our growth coming from unproductive housing and condo construction, a lot of the growth coming from massive, massive increase in population, not having any productivity growth in at least 20 years, probably 30, more like 30, 35 years. Those structural secular issues in Canada are problematic and they still exist. I would say where we're sort of optimistic is the direction of policy right now appears to be more laser focused on solving this very, very important and critical. I would say it's the most important issue in Canada. People will disagree, but solving this long-term productivity challenge, right? There is nothing more important. And the reason productivity is important is if you have kind of weak productivity growth or really lagging productivity versus other countries, you don't really notice it until you go to those other places and you think, wow, like, you know, the gap between the city I live in and the city I'm visiting, I never remember it being so large, right? So productivity is the magic potion for raising standards of living, which is why all of us are obsessed with it on our team. And I think what we're seeing right now is policy at the kind of federal government level that is more geared towards investment, right? Like long-term investment, capital investment, and setting the conditions in place for that. And I mean, some of it has obviously come from, you know, the fire being sort of closer to our rear ends because of the tariff shock. And those trading patterns are not going to be removed overnight, nor are the interprovincial trade barriers. But our sense is the direction of travel here is quite a bit more positive than it was for the prior 10 years.
Yeah. And that's a relative distinction. It's not an absolute distinction. It's not that things are great. It's that they've gone from less good to better.
Exactly.
I thought there's a those are the distinctions that the market drives on.
Exactly. Exactly.
Everything is relative.
Exactly. And I always think in terms of rates of change, not in absolute kind of levels, right? The deltas, as we talk about. A great example of that is, and we've talked about this in the past, is, you know, the resource extraction sector in Canada. Underlying the detailed national accounts data, the GDP data, we get capital spending, capital expenditure, and it's inflation adjusted. If you look at that line item in the GDP report, from 2014 to 2024, the amount of capital spending in terms of oil and gas extraction in Canada in inflation adjusted terms fell by 50%. Okay. Fell by 50%. Used to be a third of every, out of every $10 a company spent in Canada, about a third of $3 was this component. It's now about 1 in 10. Even that just becoming slightly less awful, right, is a significant tailwind, right? So again, these are the kinds of things and signals we're looking at. But at the same time, the footnote is we have our work cut out for us. And a lot of those things have not really gone away that we've talked about in the past.
It's a slow moving ship. It's not something that's going to, you know, get turned over quickly. It's something that's going to be negotiated. I think the thing that I've sort of come to realize over the course of the summer was that, you know, we have gotten used to the temperature of the water.
Right.
You know, right. Like we're like the boiled frog sitting in, you know, the hot water and thinking, this isn't so bad after all. You know, it's 150 degrees, but it's not.
No. And
we're still okay.
Exactly. I mean, so, you know, it's really striking when you look at the capital investment numbers over a long period of time, right? Over 10 or 15 year horizon, because people think, oh, this weak productivity or the surge in productivity in the US and the AI dividend, oh, wow, this just came out of nowhere. No, it didn't, right? So what did the US do? They, instead of just building condos and flipping condo assignments, they actually, you know, they invested in productive capital through a wide range of things. A lot more of it is now going towards software. You know, in the 80s and 90s, they went to like property and plant and equipment, and today it goes more towards intellectual property and software. So it's a little bit trickier to measure. But the dividends, I mean, this is, again, the reason that you have to invest in these productive sources of capital or capital investment is the productivity dividend you get at the end. And so the US was seeing that last year. You know, it's come under threat now, but that secular AI productivity story is not really going anywhere. I think we're probably just at the beginning of it. And in Canada, we're feeling the effects of 10 years or 15 years of kind of underinvestment. But again, if it's not getting much worse from here, and in fact, maybe is getting slightly better, there is that opportunity for additional basis points from an asset allocation perspective if we are neutral, you know, versus our strategic allocation. And compared to the US, you know, whereas the US, we're kind of underweight, right? So that's kind of how we have to think about things from an asset allocation perspective.
I kind of liken it to, you know, the dials on an equalizer.
Exactly.
You know, where on one end you have, you know, you have bass, at the other end you have treble, and in between you have all the midtones, but you can play around with those dials. And in the center of that dial range is zero, right? Which is your neutral.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
This is,
yeah,
no change.
No, you know,
so you can increase your bass, you can increase your treble or cut it if it's too sharp.
Exactly.
You can play around with those dials. But I think that to me is such a great analogy for asset allocation.
I would agree. And I'm actually, Pierre, I'm gonna steal that because I mean, you must be a recovering audio hi-fi guy. But I'm the same way. I mean, this office I'm sitting in is actually just, you know, full of guitar amplifiers. So that's a big hobby of mine. And exactly to your point, I mean, in trying to achieve, you know, that perfect Dwayne Allman or Jerry Garcia tone, I've spent my entire life tweaking those knobs and pedals in order to achieve that. And that's not that dissimilar to, you know, what we're doing in the funds, right? We're leaning into some things, leaning away from others in order to achieve that position that we think will accurately or effectively beat our underlying benchmarks, right? A very good analogy. And actually, I'm going to admit, Pierre, I'm definitely stealing that. So,
well, you're more than welcome. I wondered going back, I remember, you know, watching the Grammys and, Beck,
oh, yeah,
won best audio mastering.
Yep.
1 year for
this is probably
the Heart is a Drum. Oh, the Heart is a Drum. Heart is a Drum.
Oh yes, yeah.
It was the song Heart is a Drum, right? And so in the song Heart is a Drum, and I thought, okay, it's a great song. You know, let's listen to it, right? So I put it on, and you know, you turn up the volume. And the clarity,
yep,
of the mastering in that particular song. So anybody, if you want to hear a song that is expertly mastered from an audio standpoint, just put that song on. The Heart is a Drum, and turn up the volume when you're in the car or wherever you are, and you'll see what I'm talking about. There is so much ambient mastering in that song. The guitar, it sounds like you're right next to it.
Well, I'm so glad you're bringing this up here as a quick diversion. So that album, which came out in 2014, Morning Phase, is absolutely masterful. I mean, it is perfect start to finish. And it's one of those albums that if you're not really into records and vinyl and you hear that on vinyl, you know, you better make some room on the credit card because you're about to buy a record player and speakers. I just had the opportunity to see Beck with the Toronto Symphony Orchestra here in Toronto. And he played several songs off that. Absolutely spectacular. Awesome. Yeah.
Awesome. Okay. So that's our analogical, our aside about the analogy.
Yeah. Those are allowed, I think. Yeah. But you know, actually one of the things you mentioned, Pierre, we talked about the US and we talked about Canada, but I would say the one thing that sort of concerns me now, and I know we're going to talk about, rates, but the latest employment readings, I'd say are problematic, right? Maybe I'll just take a couple minutes on that. And because it relates really to the path of rates, unsurprisingly, right?
Cutting it very close. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So earlier this year, I was on a Fidelity Connects webcast earlier this year, and I said, the Fed would love to be done. And I really knew, I did believe that then, and I sort of still believe it now. Like, inflation, well, what did we know on inflation? Inflation was very low and stable pre-pandemic. It shot higher, right? 8% and 9% in Canada and the US. It rolled over, and inflation has been slowly coming back down to where we want it to be in the US, but it's not yet where it should be, right? So inflation should be here, and inflation is now here. And for the last few months, it's sort of moved sideways, right? So core and total CPI in the US is sitting near 3. It's a little bit lower on a PCE basis, but that's not where the Fed would like it to be. And I would say progress is, that last mile has proven to be difficult. Progress has kind of stalled, and things have moved sideways. So the Fed would love to be done because, rates are still in the 4s. They're still restrictive, and they would love to keep them there until they really get that firm check mark in the biggest Sharpie on inflation. But what's happened, and the way that this has evolved, is they cannot afford to be stubborn on inflation anymore because of what's happened in the labor market. But again,
right,
whenever we're thinking about monetary policy, I think oftentimes in our industry, we really, really overthink central bank decisions. We hyper-focus on every dot and the move in the dot and every line and every speech. But the way to think about things from a high level is always use two things to think about the path of rates: employment and inflation, right? That's the starting point in terms of what you should use as a map. Inflation is not where they'd want it, so they'd love to keep things sort of restrictive. But the U.S. job market is now showing, I would say, signs of weakness. So what do we know? On Friday last week, we got the August employment report, right? Happens first Friday of every month. We know this. We got 22,000 jobs added. Thing to keep in mind here is the standard error on that estimate is roughly 100,000, right? Plus or minus 100,000. So that could have been 122 or minus 88. And that's not a good number, right? Number one. Number two, we had these benchmark revisions, which again have somehow become politicized, but we had these benchmark revisions which showed almost 1 million fewer jobs created in the year ending in March. That's not good. And then the third thing is the unemployment rate continues to kind of drift higher. Taken together, I think this suggests that, and this is exactly how I think they'll communicate it, is the Fed can no longer afford to be as restrictive as they've been in the past. Basically 3 cuts are priced in between now and the end of this year. We might get 3, we might get 2, but I certainly think we're heading lower for the remainder of this year. And to be quite honest, I think that's the right decision, right? In other words, sticking the landing would be no further implosion of, no serious or significant implosion of the U.S. labor market. And you have to trade off some inflation. The worst case outcome, you can probably guess what this is going to be, is, rates are lowered, 2 or 3 times. That reignites the consumer and hiring together, mixed in with that big, beautiful bill. and lower corporate taxes results in a lift in, you know, consumer spending and business investment, pushes job growth higher, pushes wages higher, pushes service prices higher, and pushes inflation higher, right? So that's that would be the sort of really downside scenario where the Fed would be caught between this. That's a very, very difficult situation if we think about those two things.
They're caught between a pillar and a post. I mean, there's still the insistence on tackling inflation, but at the same time, the economy is showing signs of weakness. The Treasury is really pushing. I mean, the administration is really pushing for more fiscal dominance.
Yeah.
And on the Fed side, you know, there's criticisms about, you know, is the Fed holding on to this 2% target too tightly?
Well,
or do they need to let go a little bit and say, okay, you know, we're going to be, let's be happy with the R star of 3% or around 3% and let go of the reins, you know, like let go of the trim.
Well, exactly.
It's a little too tight.
I mean, exactly. So layered on top of this is kind of political interference with monetary policy making.
Yeah.
That's definitively unhealthy.
That's like a wrestling match that's been going on.
Right. And you know, to the Fed's credit, they've kind of stuck to their knitting and stayed the course based on that tremendous like army of researchers and surveys. Credibility. Like think back to Volcker, right? So credibility takes an extremely long time to develop and is lost in, you know, lost in a moment. If you get political appointees to become members of the Fed, I think this is a serious and significant potential slide in credibility that really underpins our underweight to U.S. equities. On Canada, just turning to Canada in terms of the employment,
but there's a very fine line for the Fed to toe, right? Which is you know, the difference between doing the right thing,
yeah,
and doing what is being requested.
Well, exactly. I mean, so and again, when I, you know, I spent
the funny thing is they may both be the right thing, but the optics are so critical.
Exactly. At this point, the optics, right? So.
Yeah.
That statement that comes out next week is going to have to be masterfully written. In fact, I'm sure they're already working on it. Again, I spent almost 10 years at the Bank of Canada. Between myself, David Tulk, David Wolf, have about a combined 20 years of experience at the Bank of Canada. The division of the, like, you know, between Parliament Hill and Bank and Spark Street, the Bank of Canada, was so important and critical when we were there, right? So oftentimes, Governor Carney at the time would get questions about, well, what do you think about the you know, expected fiscal spending to blah, blah, blah. And there was a canned line, you know, I never comment on, you know, decisions by the government. And then,
right,
you know, Minister Flaherty would get questions about, what do you think about the Bank of Canada potentially da, da, da. And he would have that same sort of canned line. Like there were two distinct lanes, and there was in fact a bike lane in between the two of them, right? So there was to torture the metaphor. There was ample space, and they would not crisscross. I think we're in a different era now, and I don't. It doesn't make me feel good when you have political interference in central banking. Again, because we've seen how these kinds of things play out in too many emerging markets to remove it.
It used to be sacred.
It used to be.
And it has, you know, has lost some of that, right?
It has. And yeah. I mean, you know, certainly more so in the U.S. than in Canada. I think, you know, there was a little bit of flirting with that in Canada, but I think, I do think there's a kind of a clear division in Canada. But in Canada, you know, the rate outlook, I think, has changed as well. I checked yesterday, we have almost three cuts priced in between now and the end of the year. I think we'll probably get something between two and three. But why is that the case? And here, the employment picture is a little bit scarier, right? So over the last 2 months, Canada has shed 106,000 jobs. We got minus 66,000 last Friday in the labor report. The unemployment rate is in the sevens now. Right, it was like 4.8, high fours in 2022. It's in the sevens now. The unemployment rate in Alberta is 8.4%. The unemployment rate in Toronto is 9%. You know, this is kind of problematic. Since 2022, 600,000 more people in Canada have been added to the unemployment line. That's not good, right? That's problematic. Rates were much lower in Canada. Rates are much lower in Canada than in the U.S. So a little bit, you know, less wiggle room, but I would expect rates to push lower because of what's happening in the labor market. And that's how it, I would think that's how it'll be communicated. The one thing that we have sort of going for us in Canada right now is inflation is sort of where it needs to be. They're still going to be very, very cautious about the potential upward shock coming from tariffs. But inflation at present is roughly, I would say, where the Bank of Canada would like it to stay and be. But they have, again, they have to take out a little bit of insurance in terms of what's happening on the labor market. And I think that'll be how it's communicated.
Now, let's shift for a moment to the question about the U.S. dollar. You point to the U.S. dollar losing its old role as a tailwind and hedge. Has recent activity reinforced that, or has the dollar surprised you? I mean, it's been kind of flat, actually, pretty much the whole summer.
It has been. You know, there's a bunch of different directions that we can go in terms of the dollar. The one thing I will mention is, you know, in the past, like I spend a lot of time on the road. You know, I think I'm going to pass 100 flights this year.
That's extraordinary.
It is, yeah. So actually, an advisor asked me earlier this year, it's like, oh my God, wow, are you married? And my answer was, we'll see. You know, I was this morning. One of the questions I used to get frequently on the road was, what's the risk of the dollar losing its reserve currency status? Right. And in the past, there's this great IMF data on foreign effects holdings in terms of how they're denominated. They update it every year. And we took that data and we put it into one of our papers, I think a year ago or a couple of years ago. And my answer to that question, I don't want to say was kind of aloof and dismissive, but probably was, if I'm giving myself a hard self-evaluation, because I said, look, like in our lifetime, the US dollar is going to be the reserve currency. Here's the data. So it shows, you know, foreign effects holdings of US dollars are very, very high, you know, in the 80s, and they kind of trim slightly lower. But this idea, I think the provocative headline was China's invoicing commodities in yuan, and the BRIC currencies are you know, coming together to come up with this other sort of invoicing type of currency, and crypto is getting more popular, and that's going to really crush the dominance, you know, US dollar dominance. And I've always been sort of dismissive of this fact. I would say today, I'm less dismissive. I still think the US dollar will be the reserve currency for our lifetimes, but I am less dismissive of this question. And actually, in yesterday's Wall Street Journal, Barry Eichengreen has done a very, very nice exposition. I can send it to you after this, but a very, very nice exposition of the US dollar as a reserve currency status. You know, it's kind of a longer essay, but it's a very nice exposition. So what does that mean for our funds? You know, historically in our funds, we have used our Canadian dollar position as a risk mitigator. And so what do I mean by that in English? We know the Canadian dollar is not a safe haven currency.
Right.
And in periods of stress, the Canadian dollar depreciates, right? March 2020, Canadian dollar depreciates. Back half of 2022, Canadian dollar depreciates. And historically in our funds, what we've done is we've used the underweight to the Canadian dollar to smooth out the ride for the end investor. It's been a very important lever for us in terms of return and in terms of risk, right? It smoothed out the bumps. We started this year with a almost 20% underweight to the Canadian dollar in our main 60-40 global balance portfolio, meaning 20% less of that fund is denominated in Canadian dollars, and basically 20% more of it is denominated in US dollars, right? Historically, when we've had that underweight to the Canadian dollar, it's basically been an overweight to the US dollar. And then two things have changed. Two important things have changed. The first is we took that 20% underweight and we've pulled it way back. Today, it sits at around a -3, right? So we're much less underweight the Canadian dollar, smaller underweight to the Canadian dollar. And two, and this is, I think, probably even more interesting, that underweight to the Canadian dollar is now an overweight to everything but the US dollar, right? So in nerdy terms, we've closed our US Canadian dollar long position, right? And that overweight to the Canadian dollar underweight is to, you know, the euro, the yen, other currencies other than the US dollar. And to your question, Pierre, why did we do that? If the underpinnings of exceptionalism are coming under attack, the variable that we think is most likely to adjust lower is the value of the exchange rate, right? The free floating exchange rate. Now, it's funny, in economics, you have this concept called observational equivalence. I think it's fascinating, right? So to get a little bit more nerdy, and observational equivalence is, you know, sort of, for example, Pierre, if you're at a party and we're both at a party and you come to talk to me and I turn a cold shoulder and I walk in the other direction, and every time you come to talk to me, I kind of blow you off, I'm observationally equivalent to being kind of and, you know, as my friend, I'm not calling myself that and you're not calling me that, but I'm observationally equivalent to that. What we're observing right now in the U.S. is they may not have called it a weak dollar policy, but in our view, it's observationally equivalent to a weak dollar policy, right? Global trade war, policy uncertainty, removing the head of the statistical agency, interfering with monetary policy. These are observationally equivalent to weak dollar policy. And the last point I'll make is here on the dollar is, if we believe the direction of travel, potential direction of travel for the dollar is lower, we don't want to expose our investors and our advisors to any additional U.S. dollar weakness. All right, so that's the full sort of arc of that discussion, from how we use it to what we've done and how we've changed the composition of the Canadian dollar underweight.
Yeah, so you're not taking a short position in the U.S. dollar, you're just taking a long position in Canadian dollars and other global currencies.
Exactly. So that composition has changed, right? And again, this is a really tricky one sometimes to explain. Like,
you're actually effectively short the dollar, but you're not. I mean, if you're long everything else, then you're effectively short.
That's right. You're not short.
Yeah.
And the other thing is, we have to be, you know, if the US dollar is depreciating, it's not impossible for the Canadian dollar to depreciate. But in general, when the US dollar is depreciating, the Canadian dollar is appreciating, right? If we think,
I said earlier that for the summer, the US dollar is being flat, but it's being flat at the bottom. It's not being flat
exactly
at the mid range. It's being flat on the bottom.
Exactly. And, you know, if I had to put a balance of risks around that, I would say, again, that I think back to that observational equivalence of weak dollar policy. I don't think I think that's kind of the direction that we're potentially heading in. Or even if we are thinking potentially that there's more downside risk to the value of the US dollar than upside, it's prudent for us to not increase exposure at all to US dollar depreciation. The other important position for us this year, I mean, we talked about a lot that has changed, right? We talked about that underpinnings of exceptionalism in the U.S. coming under pressure. So from moving from an overweight to an underweight, pulling in the Canadian equity underweight to a neutral, the change in the size and composition of the Canadian dollar underweight. The other two that really stick out in my head is Europe and gold, right? So Europe, for example, like, as asset allocators, we can't be defensive everywhere. And that underweight, a lot of people, sometimes people ask, you know, the underweight to the US equity market, where do the proceeds of that go? And you know, the other position that we implemented at the start of this year was an overweight to Europe. Again, we think Europe galvanized in the start of this year, right? Valuations are an important input into our process. But the way that we think about valuations is valuations need a catalyst in order for that price action to kind of, awaken. And I think in the early part of this year, when Europe sort of figured out that the US was no longer that global referee, and they couldn't have defense spending, Germany couldn't have defense spending that's 1% of GDP like it has been for the last 20 or 30 years, that sort of awoken some of those, some of those spirits in terms of galvanizing Europe to maybe underspend less on defense. And a great example is look up the stock price of the German aerospace defense company, Rheinmetall. If you want to see galvanization in one chart, that's the chart. It's really incredible. And so we're overweight Europe, which, you know, which has been the right decision since the start of this year. And then the other one,
which is an allocation of what in the portfolio?
So that's an allocation again to the underlying managers that would manage that Europe sleeve for us. All right. So it's up to them. It's up to them sort of what style and sector they choose. But for us, it's really an overweight to that Europe or EFI sector. That division of labor really is. That asset allocation overlay is more Europe sourced from an underweight to the US, and then those underlying managers doing what they do best. The other one just to sneak in is gold, right? I mean, gold could be a whole other podcast. I'm sure you're speaking to gold experts that take up the entire time, but gold for us has been an important position this year, out of benchmark position, about 2.5% to an ETF exposure.
Right.
And the reason for that is, and it's fascinating as a researcher, having done this research and now seeing it implemented in the funds, is there's really no better exposure if you want to hedge inflation or inflation volatility or expected inflation or volatility or geopolitical risk. And if you think of that as the checklist, I think we checked every single one of those things. And so gold prices certainly have pushed higher this year, which has been an important driver of return. But even with a small position that we have in the funds that we manage.
Good. I'm glad that you covered that. Ilan, just to wrap up, your neutral Canada, neutral US, overweight Europe.
Neutral Canada, underweight US.
Overweight Europe.
Overweight gold.
And I just want to clarify, like, because I want to close off on the active management discussion to talk about, like, being underweight US equities does not mean being out of the US. First of all, and secondly, a lot of that shift in underweight US has come from your decision to become more selective.
Exactly. I mean, Pierre, honestly, this is such a critical point. I'm glad you're stressing it again. Underweight does not mean selling out of an asset class. Critically important, right? A large chunk of these portfolios generally are US equities. We're trimming that in favor of another asset class or geography that we think will sort of win the race over a tactical horizon. That's absolutely critical, really critical. The other thing I'd mention is, as you know, the positioning in these funds will evolve, right? Based on the research, based on those four pillars that we follow so closely. Again, I think about when I started, a good mentor of mine said, the way that we manage these funds is we add one basis point to the mountain, one basis point at a time, right? And so that's the philosophy that we use to kind of manage them.
Fantastic. One quick last question. What kind of opportunities do you see your active managers that you're leaning into? What kind of opportunities do you see that they're uncovering or are they uncovering versus what might be missed in passive positions?
It's remarkable, right? It is absolutely remarkable. I'll share with you also after this discussion, a fantastic chart showing the actual experience of the global balanced 60-40 portfolio versus a Canadian 60-40. So think of that as like the passive option, right? A Canadian 60-40 versus this globally diversified 60-40 that we're managing, where we pick every single manager No managers are forced upon us. We pick every manager and we lean in and out of asset classes, geography, style, sectors, currencies. The wedge at the end of this 11-year period is over 40%, right? And 29, 30% of it is coming from the managers that we've selected doing a great job against their benchmarks. And then another 13, 14% is coming from us leaning in or out of asset classes and currencies and geographies. So it's an incredible proof point, this chart, because it is exactly to your point, the reason to use very strong active managers and overlay that tactical asset, the active asset allocation process on top of it, right? I mean, it's the proof is the results, to be quite frank.
Right.
So, and it's, you know, no managers are forced upon us, right? We're never, ever forced to use a new manager or a manager that's underperforming. We choose every single person on the team and then pick the lines based on that four-pillar research process.
Excellent. Ilan, thank you so much. It's been terrific to catch up with you. Always terrific to catch up with you. I'm looking forward to seeing your next report and getting you back on to continue this conversation.
Thank you.